You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Good Fight by Dave Cullen. There's a mythology about the Sandy Hook aftermath. Call it the Hodges Doctrine. In 2015, after yet another mass shooting, pundit Dan Hodges tweeted, "In retrospect, Sandy Hook marked the end of the U.S. gun control debate. Once America decided killing children was bearable, it was over." The observation wasn't original, but it crystallized the conventional wisdom. It goes viral. After every mass shooting, Moms Demand Action founder Shannon Watts says, and people retweet it, and they say, "This is so true." It's not. But it's become the liberal answer to the do-nothing conservative refrain of thoughts and prayers. "That makes me so mad," Watts says. "The day Sandy Hook rocked America, the NRA had Congress in its pocket and the Obama administration in check. We had no political movement that could go toe-to-toe with them," Watts says. "That has to be built." It was one day after Sandy Hook that Watts started a Facebook group that evolved into Moms Demand Action, which later merged with Mike Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns to form Every Town for Gun Safety. Sandy Hook also inspired Gabby and Kelly in 2013 to create the organization that would evolve into Giffords Courage. Today, the NRA has two major adversaries, neither of which existed 7 years ago. The Hodges Doctrine has it backward. Sandy Hook was the birth of the modern gun safety movement. Before founding Giffords Courage, Gabby quietly met with members of Congress, frequently accompanied by Peter Ambler and Kelly. Ambler says they would walk into Senate offices and hear, "I admire what you're doing, but this is just too hard for me politically. The NRA is just too powerful. The politics are too tough." Ambler says John McCain told them he agreed with much of their agenda, but he felt like our reward would be in heaven. That's when Gabby, Kelly, and Ambler reached their key insight. The senators were right. The NRA was too powerful. No matter how grave the horror or fierce the public outcry, the politicians would ignore it until someone proved it was safe to vote their conscience here on Earth. They were sure candidates could win on guns. The problem was getting them to run on it. And the listener needs to recognize that this article went to press about a year ago, slightly more. Ambler summarizes the core Giffords Courage philosophy. "We can't just elect the right people to office. They have to be elected because of, not in spite of, their support for gun safety. When we look at people seeking our endorsement, it's not just, 'Do you agree with us on the policy?' It's, 'Are you making this part of your campaign and part of your fundamental case to voters?' What you need is a president, a Congress, state legislatures, governors, mayors, etc., who have a popular mandate from voters to act on gun safety. And the only way you get a popular mandate is to talk about the issue, and then, of course, to win. Every Town and Giffords Courage both grew into political powerhouses, with Every Town's army of moms providing the ground force and Giffords organizing the inside game. The Giffords Courage team devised a five-stage plan to pass the sort of landmark legislation Biden has finally proposed. 1. Put some legislative wins on the board. 2. Devise a winning message. 3. Prove it out in key test elections. 4. Coax candidates to run on gun safety in numbers that would overwhelm NRA resources. 5. Take the House, Senate, and White House, all with a mandate for change. Small victories are won in state capitals, so that's where the early battles were fought. The NRA was on the move, chipping away at longtime gun regulations, working state by state with model legislation to allow concealed weapons and create new stand-your-ground laws that expand the self-defense concept to permit civilians to use lethal force against perceived threats. Florida police said the law kept them from charging and arresting George Zimmerman for fatally shooting Trayvon Martin, an unarmed African-American teenager, in 2012. Zimmerman was finally arrested after a public outcry, only to be acquitted under the self-defense statute. Georgia police used the same reasoning in spring when they waited 10 weeks before arresting two men in the fatal shooting of Ahmaud Arbery, another unarmed black man. It took another 2 weeks to arrest a third man for blocking his escape. All three have since been charged and have pleaded not guilty. At first, the state battles felt futile as the NRA kept racking up wins, but the safety movement was gaining intel for the next stage, testing messages while rapidly building the infrastructure to compete. This meant funding sources, volunteers, lobbyists, lawyers, policy wonks, communications people, market testers. Getting the message right was essential. Gabby had the instincts because she grew up in the heart of gun country. She gets the NRA demo because she is that demo. They pitched ideas, hashed them out with candidates, and then tested the hell out of them. That's why we poll before we advertise. That's why we poll after we advertise, Ambler says. The first thing to go was the movement's self-defeating name. Gun control might as well have been designed in a lab to alarm gun rights zealots. Worse, it perpetuates the concept of a zero-sum game, where every increase in control begets an equal loss of rights. It cast Gabby's side as freedom haters intent on snatching up all the gun rights, even if those rights were just invented by the NRA. Giffords Courage advises candidates to emphasize the values of safety and responsibility. Freedom, too, with the caveat that with freedom comes responsibility. Elizabeth Warren speaks that message naturally. At the Giffords Gun Forum last fall, she said, "I grew up in a family with guns. All three of my brothers have guns. My brothers did some hunting and shooting behind our house. I mean, it was mostly squirrels and rabbits, but that's what they did. But that's not gun violence." The signal was clear to both sides. Your guns are safe. I'm not here to control or even reform them, just the violence. In 2016, Giffords Courage proceeded to stage 3, convincing test elections. Ambler calls it proof of concept. They needed a smart, strong candidate to run on guns, take on the NRA, and win. And they had to do it in gun country. While the nation focused on Clinton versus Trump, Giffords went hard in New Hampshire. Republican Kelly Ayotte was favored to hold her Senate seat, but not overwhelmingly. If they could take her out in the rural live-free-or-die state, that would turn heads. The Giffords team huddled with Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan, who was eager to test her D rating with the NRA against Ayotte. Giffords hammered Ayotte with nearly $1.5 million in ads, and 2 months before Election Day, the New York Times reported that she had scrambled to tack left and soften her pro-gun positions. Hassan won, even as her party lost the presidency and picked up just one other vulnerable Senate seat. Defeating Ayotte was a defining moment for Giffords' courage, Ambler says. We were able to show, 3 years after she sided with the NRA and voted against expanded background checks, that there was a political cost to voting against safer gun laws, even in a purple gun-owning state like New Hampshire. We weren't just right on the issue. Gun safety was a winning issue. Heading into 2018, Giffords' courage felt the political winds were finally favorable enough to proceed to Stage 4, in which a phalanx of candidates would run aggressively on guns. They were deep into the vetting phase when Parkland happened. On Valentine's Day, a gunman opened fire at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, killing 17 people and injuring 17 others. The shooting was tragically familiar, but the survivor's response was new. A group of savvy students organized the March for Our Lives, which energized millions of high school and college students, an uprising that captivated the nation. Giffords' courage had targeted 2018 as the year to go wide. The Parkland uprising was rocket fuel. Moms Demand Action created Students Demand Action, which has chapters at 400 high schools and colleges. That's in addition to MFOL's 300 school chapters. Watts says Moms Demand Action tripled its membership that year to more than 6 million. Suddenly, it was larger than the NRA. Americans realized they needed to get off the sidelines, Watts says. We immediately took that newfound size and translated it into political power. The NRA got pummeled in the midterms. Democrats flipped the House and picked up 40 seats, their best showing in a congressional election since the post-Watergate landslide of 1974. The party also flipped 349 state legislative seats, 6 state legislative chambers, and 7 governorships, most in large battleground states. Those would be crucial to the big redistricting fights ahead following the 2020 census. Frustration with Donald Trump's shambolic presidency was undoubtedly the big force behind the blue wave. But people on both sides of the gun debate were finally voting on the issue. CNN's exit poll showed that gun control was the fourth most important voter issue after health care, immigration, and the economy. The NBC exits found that 60% of voters favored stronger gun laws, including a startling 42% of gun owners. And the state legislatures, consistently on the forefront on guns, felt the wave rising and collectively reversed course. After decades of NRA dominance, states passed only 9 pro-gun laws last year and an unprecedented 67 gun safety bills. The NRA's aura of invincibility was shattered, Spitzer says. It had this reputation. If they target you for defeat, that A, they'll make your life miserable, and B, they'll probably succeed. That narrative held until 2018, he said, with the political class treating gun safety as a third rail. It's no longer a third rail, Spitzer says. It's been deactivated, de-electrified. NRA fundraising has sputtered, and it finished 2018 $36 million in the red. The organization has been plagued by reports of lavish spending and profiteering by executives. A bitter power struggle between its president, Oliver North, and executive vice president, Wayne LaPierre, resulted in North's ouster last year, followed by the resignation of 8 board members and sweeping layoffs. The harshest blow came on August 6th, a year ago, August 6th, when New York Attorney General Letitia James announced a civil suit seeking to dissolve the organization. "The NRA is fraught with fraud and abuse," she said, charging that top executives funneled millions into their own pockets. Because the NRA is chartered in New York, the state could potentially shut it down. After Gabby wowed the SEAL team in Kandahar in 2008, Jimmy Hatch invited her to skydive with them at their training facility outside Tucson. He was stunned when she accepted and surprised each step of the way. "I thought, okay, she's going to come in with a posse," he told me. "She showed up by herself, wearing a sweatshirt, a pair of jeans." "First-timers tend to lose their shit when they board the plane," he said. Gabby was chatty, asking about the crew so she could thank them later. The following year, Hatch was seriously injured leading a mission to rescue the American POW Bo Bergdahl from the Taliban. Gabby visited him in the hospital and told him she was heading back to see his SEAL team in Afghanistan. He gave her the names of 4 guys who had saved his life on the operation and asked her for a big favor. "She didn't write anything down," he says. "She went over there, and I didn't hear from her about it. But my buddy called me and was like, 'Jimmy, what did you tell Gabby?' She got out of the plane, walked past all the high-ranking people, walked over to the guys in our crew and said, 'Hey, who's so-and-so?' Gave them a hug. 'Who's so-and-so?' Gave him a hug. Only after she'd found and greeted all 4 did she go inside for the Q&A. Gabby has always been a magnet for service members and veterans. That's been a powerful, unforeseen asset in her new mission. "We organize the people that haven't historically been part of the gun violence prevention movement," Ambler says. Gabby has personally recruited a growing cadre of veterans and law enforcement officers to run on gun safety. Candidates with the credibility to reach gun owners. And she has enlisted high-profile generals, including Stanley McChrystal, Russell Honoré, and Michael Vincent Hayden, for a series of video testimonials. "They are essential to beating the NRA once and for all," Ambler says. "Left versus right takes you back to square one. We also need to own the center. That's how you create generational change. That's how you foundationally shift our politics." One step remains in the Giffords Courage 5-stage program. Gabby couldn't make the 2020 election about gun safety. A presidential nominee could. That election will be decided by COVID-19, and the listener must remember this article was in the magazine before the NRA took a gigantic tumble and before the 2020 election. This election will be decided by COVID-19. But by going so big on guns, Biden has all but ensured that a victory for his ticket will usher in historic change. And that dynamic was cemented in 2019. The October Gun Safety Forum, October a year ago, was Giffords' pivotal event. "We literally built a stage for the candidates to get on and talk about gun violence," Ambler says. The forum drew a lot of media coverage, but most of the real work happened in advance. Putting the candidates on notice and giving them a deadline to formulate a gun safety agenda. Most of the heavy lifting came in the spring of 2019, when major candidates kept one-upping each other with the most aggressive plan. Senator Kamala Harris was first out of the gate, announcing that April that she'd take executive actions to tighten regulations on manufacturers, expand background checks, and close the boyfriend loophole if Congress didn't act in the first 100 days of her presidency. Biden released his plan the day of the event. All 10 leading Democratic candidates agreed to address the forum, though Senator Bernie Sanders had a heart attack the night before and called in sick. Gabby had a grueling schedule, meeting with each candidate individually and making several appearances on stage, including a 41-second opening speech. I spent all day with her, and there were no official breaks, just a moment or two when she could wolf down a coffee or a bite. Every time she had a free moment, she repeated the same two sentences, fighting for every word. Gun violence is now a kitchen table issue for millions. How do you talk about gun violence at your kitchen table? It was a question she would pose to Biden from the audience during his 30-minute discussion with host Craig Melvin, broadcast live on MSNBC. Gabby nailed the question. Biden fumbled the answer. He meandered, backtracked, and tripped over preambles for a full minute before even addressing it. And then, the way I talk to my grandchildren about it. My two granddaughters are, I have four granddaughters for dinner last night at my house in Delaware. My fifth granddaughter, I had three granddaughters. My fourth one, I have five grandchildren. My oldest one, it was painful to watch. The crowd was revved at his opening, and you could feel the air deflate. But near the end of his 30 minutes, he found his footing. If you're duck hunting, hunting for Canadian geese, you cannot have a shotgun with more than three shells, he said. We protect ducks and geese better than we protect people. The audience howled, and the energy returned to the room, at least for a few moments. Biden's bumbling is not unique to this issue, but it was painfully clear how long it had been since he'd led on guns. He's come a long way in the intervening year. Ambler says the key is that this movement has been led by survivors of gun violence, and Biden's history of painful losses gives him a deep well of empathy to draw from. COVID-19 scuttled Gabby's 2020 plans to hit the road hard in every state that could decide the presidency and control of the Senate. But lockdown also presented an opportunity. In February of that year, in the lull before the nomination, she had begun work on a speech. When the pandemic hit, Gabby hatched a new plan. She would master a speech, the longest she'd attempted since the Safeway shooting, to deliver at the Democratic National Convention. Pulling it off would require 3 2-hour speech therapy sessions a week, plus homework every day for 6 full months. She hoped to deliver it from a Milwaukee stage, but when the convention went virtual, she pre-recorded it. The organization regrouped, too. Gifford's Courage continued working with campaigns on messaging, and Gabby did a series of virtual events with Senate candidates from 8 states, mostly in gun country. She's been most active in the Arizona race, where her husband, Mark Kelly, was fighting to unseat Republican Senator Martha McSally. Kelly held a razor-thin lead that fall and widened it over the summer. Gabby has been highly visible in his online campaign and has joined him in a series of Instagram videos. And again, the listener must remember that this article was also before the Arizona elections. All the many speeches complicated work on the big one, but Fabi says Gabby keeps them all loaded in her head like DVR episodes. Just cue her with the first few words, and she can take it from there. The first 2 nights of the Democratic National Convention were all about Trump and his failures, but Wednesday's broadcast dove deep into policy, climate change, border policy, and gun safety. after inspiring video of teenagers marching and Emma Gonzalez chanting, "We call BS," it was time for Gabby's speech. An opening montage shows Gabby raising two fingers to speak from her hospital bed, returning to Congress emaciated and practicing her speech. "He was there for me," Gabby says. "He'll be there for you too." She hits the line and high-fives Fabi. You can see how hard she's been working, but did you imagine she'd put in 130 hours of practice? Then Gabby rises and hobbles to a lectern before a massive American flag, like the one flapping behind her the day she was taken down. She delivers her speech in a single take, 84 seconds, 21 sentences, 155 words. "I've known the darkest of days," she begins. She describes pain, despair, and uncertainty. "And yet, confronted by paralysis and aphasia, I put one foot in front of the other, I found one word, and then I found another." At this new kind of convention, Biden, finally catching up with modern media, amplified Gabby's call to action across two nights and two platforms, tweeting in real time to his 8.7 million followers and continuing the message in his acceptance speech the following night. "Biden, I'm doing this for Gabby. I'm doing this for so many families who have lost a loved one to gun violence. Gabby, today I struggle to speak, but I have not lost my voice. Biden, I hear their voices, and if you listen, you can hear them too. Gabby, we are at a crossroads. We can let the shooting continue, or we can act. Biden, I made a promise to families hurt by gun violence to never, ever give up on the fight. Gabby, we can protect our families, our future. We can vote. We can be on the right side of history. Biden, we're going to be on the right side of history. Gabby, we must elect Joe Biden. He was there for me. He'll be there for you, too. Join us in this fight. Vote. 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 Biden had found his voice on guns. He echoed much of what Gabby had said, but one line addressed the founding principle of her organization. Our nation's gun violence epidemic is really a cowardice problem, he tweeted. It was quite an admission. That's been Gabby's message to the political class all along. All they're really lacking is courage. Thank you. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Vera Wang, the legendary fashion designer on Shakespeare, Elizabeth I, and Proust himself. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Is there such a thing? I guess for me, it's really about life's special moments, large and small. What is your greatest fear? Pain. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Elizabeth I. She was a woman operating in a man's world, and her very survival was always in play. Which living person do you most admire? Those who put others first. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? The desire to please. It's a losing battle. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Cruelty. No, maybe dishonesty or disingenuousness. All are equally deplorable. What is your favorite journey? A creative one. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Moderation. On what occasion do you lie? Too often, to myself, or to be kind. Which living person do you most despise? Anyone with a lack of conscience. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Seriously? What is your greatest regret? Not having pursued a career as a film director. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Figure skating and, obviously, fashion. When and where were you happiest? In an ice rink, skating. Which talent would you most like to have? Easy, the ability to sing. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? That I had had more time for them. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Work ethic. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A first responder. What is your most treasured possession? My memories, good, great, even bad, they serve me well. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Loneliness, illness, poverty, starvation, what the world is confronting right now. What is your favorite occupation? Creating or eating. What is your most marked characteristic? Curiosity. What do you most value in your friends? Loyalty. Who are your favorite writers? In particular, right now, Margaret Atwood and William Shakespeare, always. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Proust. He was a social observer, kind of like the Instagram of his time. Who are your heroes in real life? First responders. What are your favorite names? Mom. How would you like to die? Peacefully. What is your motto? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Vera Wang.
Thank you.
about face. When our bodies fall out of view, what remains on screen has our undivided attention. Marisa Meltzer considers the new primacy of the face. It's early on a Sunday evening, and I'm watching as Julianne Moore's face fills the frame in Tom Ford's 2009 film, A Single Man. Her eyes generously lined and false eyelashes applied just so. My phone pings with an alarm for a video call. By now, we have heard what Ford, a designer whose clothes telegraph sex appeal, has to say about looking good on camera, and I allow him to direct my close-up. I stack a few books under my laptop and angle a lamp in an approximation of flattering light. It's just a check-in with friends, but if this is the only way I am seeing them, I might as well put my best face forward. It has come to this. After years spent agonizing over the shape of our bodies above all else, this panoply of screens has narrowed our worldview, concentrating our focus and our concerns above the neck. Whether we're FaceTiming with family, tuning in to see Florence Pugh make marmalade on Instagram Live, or joining a 20-person Zoom meeting for work, we are all disembodied faces now. No wonder we don't feel holy ourselves. I thought I would feel a rush of relief that no one could see my lower half, a freedom that I could participate in all those video chats in sweatpants. Instead, I feel exposed in this all-face, all-the-time moment. It's not easy to see a thumbnail of my face talking back at me. What a triggering word. Zoom, for all those who avoid looking too closely in the mirror. Each perceived imperfection is amplified. Close-ups betray our every emotion, our exhaustion, our inescapable aging. It's as if this glut of screen time has turned the usual voyeurism of modern culture inward, so that by constantly seeing ourselves, we've become our own reality TV stars. I didn't sign up to be the face of anything, says Brooklyn-based facialist Laura Kaiser. Like many whose hands-on work evaporated with the stay-at-home orders, she felt the pressure to stay relevant by assuming a place in front of a camera, posting tutorials on social media. I did buy a ring light and have done two videos that were well-received, but it doesn't come naturally to me, Kaiser says. She is not about to join TikTok to post Get Ready With Me videos along with Gen Z. Mostly, she has been sending her clients private videos of Gua Sha tutorials or helping them do basic brow maintenance over FaceTime. I like to make other people pretty. The desire for improvement doesn't end during a shutdown. Wrinkles, under-eye circles, and maskne, the portmanteau for irritated skin and clogged pores exacerbated by face coverings, might send us seeking the quick-fix technological aid offered by filters. I am a loyal convert to the touch-up-my-appearance option on Zoom, which, according to the platform, can help smooth out the skin tone on your face to present a more polished-looking appearance when you display your video to others. But a filter only takes you so far. Months into quarantine, my not even vain friends have asked me about maintenance, the blanket term for the toolkit of non-invasive procedures that can be subtly deployed to forestall the inevitable. Squinting into the screen at the ever-deepening web of crow's feet, intensified further by said squinting, as a way of steering people toward injectables. I've never heard of people wanting Botox so bad, says Lisa Goodman, the owner of Good Skin, a med spa with locations in Los Angeles and New York City. A lot of people have never gone this long without it. We got offered money to make house calls and said no, although I know people who did them. Ahead of the L.A. clinic's reopening back in May, devotees claimed a spot on the wait list for the first appointments. After sheltering in place to flatten a rising curve, people clamored for treatments intended to flatten another one, the nosedive into old. Were it not for the temporary stop, since lifted, on elective surgery, this would have been a perfect time to get a facelift or a new nose. Lie low for a few months, letting things comfortably heal behind a mask, and voila, you emerge from your quarantine chrysalis with a whole new identity. Still, makeup remains the original and arguably more recession-friendly means of transformation. In late April, an unrecognizable Kylie Jenner stunned the paparazzi and fans when she emerged without the usual spackling of contour and highlight. It was an extreme make-under, a dismantling of illusion. The photos circling the internet recalled an Oscar Wilde line, "A man's face is his autobiography. A woman's face is her work of fiction." Much as we like to think that the pandemic is an equalizing force, the gender divide in beauty, as in parenting, proves to be largely intact. One master of makeup transformation was the 90s icon Kevin O'Quan, who had a talent for giving one celebrity another's likeness. During the downtime in recent months, makeup artists have been using their own faces as canvases. "I was craving playing with makeup and touching makeup," says Grace Ahn, the New York-based makeup artist who has refashioned herself into an ashes-to-ashes era David Bowie, Andy Warhol's Mick Jagger painting, and longtime Vogue editor Diana Vreeland, who went heavy on the blush. Fellow makeup artists often joined in via the group video app House Party to show off their wild solo experiments. At first, Ahn found it strange to navigate around her own asymmetries and idiosyncratic features, more comfortable playing artist than model, but she settled into the idea. When it comes to makeup, it's never perfect because faces are not perfect, she says. I transferred that philosophy to myself. The project has changed her notion of perfection and, by extension, marveling at a face usually behind the scenes might succeed in changing our perspectives too.
Thank you.
on the watch list. Court order. Richard Lawson reviews the newest iteration of a classic legal drama. This ain't your granddaddy's Perry Mason, though he might also enjoy HBO's new take on author Earl Stanley Gardner's iconic character. Beloved for decades on television in the form of Raymond Burr, the defense lawyer gets new life from the Americans veteran Matthew Rhys. A hard-boiled noir full of blood, sex, and profanity, this Perry Mason is both daring and artful in the manner of today's glossiest prestige television. Joining Rhys is Rogue's gallery of talent, including Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black, Juliet Rylance from The Nick, and Gail Rankin from Glow. The show is rich with period detail and a grim pathos that adds resonance to the courtroom intrigue, an engrossing 8-episode origin story that sets the table for future legal adventures. In the photos, Earl Stanley Gardner wrote 82 books in the series beginning in 1933, and one of them is pictured here, Raymond Burr. Debbie Reynolds in the 1989 TV movie The Case of the Musical Murder. Monty Markham in the 1973 single-season revival, The New Perry Mason. Matthew Rhys stars in the HBO adaptation and is pictured here, and a radio serial adaptation ran on CBS from 1943 to 1955. A Ghost from Our Past by Sonia Soraya. Pictured here, Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze, throwing more than clay. The clay transforms beneath Demi Moore's hands as Patrick Swayze's slide over them. The Righteous Brothers croon Unchained Melody mournfully from the jukebox. Ghost won Whoopi Goldberg an Oscar and cemented Swayze's heartthrob status, but the 1990 film is best known for its unbridled eroticism behind the pottery wheel, a thirst that even death can't quench. Now, at its 30th anniversary, the film is hallucinatory. New York's streets are crowded. Swayze and Tony Goldwyn joke about contagion in a packed elevator, and the cozy lover's nest in Soho is the size of a Madewell. But it's still more relevant than ever. Ghost is a paean to grief, a blueprint for sobbing your heart out. At its center is Goldberg's Oda Mae Brown, an irrepressible, opinionated medium who adds unadulterated attitude to the sweeping emotions of a young widow. She walks the characters through the struggle of saying goodbye, seasoning bitter truths with salty humor. I defy you not to laugh at her droll delivery of Molly, you in danger, girl. As cities remain shuttered, we need Oda Mae and Ghost dedication to its timeless love more than ever. We wait, we mourn, we cry, we heal. Time goes by so slowly, go those lyrics, and time can do so much. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.